Расстрел в самом центре Москвы.
В Москве убит известный политик Борис Немцов.
Информация о том, что Борис Ефимович Немцов убит, подтверждается.
Убит Борис Ефимович Немцов.
Женя Немцов прогуливался со своей знакомой по Большому Каменному.
Сегодня нам сообщили, что одна из пуль попала в сердце Бориса Немцова.
Осматривают тело Бориса Немцова и параллельно опрашивают его спутницу. Известно, что они встретились около ГУМа примерно в 11 вечера.
It happened in the center of Moscow, blocks from the Kremlin. It was a professional job, executed with military efficiency. The victim was a fierce critic of Vladimir Putin, who was under intense surveillance, and the assassins got away clean. I think we all know what we're going to be talking about today, and by now, we all know the details. And reasonable people may disagree on whether Boris Nemtsov's assassination was most likely ordered by the Kremlin, was the work of rogue elements in the security services, or of emboldened nationalists. But such a brazen hit on such a high-profile opposition figure is clearly a major watershed in Russian politics. In an article this week, Clifford Gaddy of the Brookings Institution wrote that the Nemtsov assassination, quote, may be a turning point in current Russian history. Unfortunately, it's almost surely not a turn for the better, but one to something bad or something even worse. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian, and indeed, happy birthday.
Thank you. As immature as I try to be, I just keep getting older. I can't do anything about it, damn it. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the newly launched SRB podcast. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thanks for joining us. Ben Judah was supposed to be joining us, but he had to pull out as he got ill. I hope, Ben, if you're listening, I hope you're feeling better, and we'd love to have you on sometime soon in the future. Well, we've all been forced to become armchair security experts in the past week, myself included. Mark, you're an actual security expert, and you wrote a piece this week on your blog that ruffled some feathers, to say the least, although it did get some support in other quarters from people the likes of Edward Lucas. Nobody would ever accuse Edward of being a Kremlin apologist, I don't think. You said we should not jump to conclusions about Kremlin involvement in this, and you very succinctly laid out your case. For the benefit of those who haven't read your blog, and shame on them, give us the Cliff Notes version.
Well, I mean, the simple point is, and in some ways, I think for some people they find it exasperatingly pedantic of me, is not that I'm suggesting for a minute that it couldn't have been the Kremlin that had Nemtsov killed. I think it's just that we need to be very, very careful about the quick assumptions that, well, obviously it must have and couldn't possibly have been anyone otherwise. But, I mean, let's start with the basics about this notion that it was quite a kind of professional hit. I personally don't see much that is that terribly professional. The one key question that we've had various hints about but is not yet explained is how they knew where he was going to be. There's been suggestions about multiple cars perhaps tracking him through the course of the day, but it could just as easily have been individuals on foot, or if we want to assume the presence of the security agencies in some way or form, tracking him by his phone. There's various ways. But anyway,
that would be the way that I would immediately go to.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I mean, that as a technical means that obviously the state can do it without any trouble, which, also throws open the options of people who are either corrupted elements of the state or semi-autonomous maverick forces. I mean, who knows? The trouble is we've seen often enough that you can get access to the information the state has, even without necessarily having an order from the Kremlin. But anyway, once we've assumed that they located him, that he's going to walk across the bridge, given that he lives across the bridge, no great surprise. One guy comes up behind him, fires six shots, hits with four at very close range. Frankly, I could do a four-shot hit at that kind of range. He uses either a converted gas pistol or a Makarov, which are not exactly high-end weapons, and from the sound of it, also old or mismatched ammunition. Doesn't check to see that Nemtsov is actually dead. I mean, four shots from a relatively low-caliber round isn't necessarily going to be automatically fatal. The usual practice amongst Russian contract killers is then to do what's called a control shot to the head. But instead just immediately runs away, jumps into a car and drives off. That does not necessarily suggest or require that it's a particularly professional hit. As again, I mean, I really need to stress that it doesn't clearly prove that it was not.
Right.
But there is just nothing there that says, I mean, the whole sort of controversies about the cameras and so forth, we still don't really know whether or not the cameras on the street, the bridge, were working or not. We've had contradictory reports. Even if they were, I mean, these are not high-resolution cameras. These are largely sort of, you know, traffic cameras and so forth. It's nighttime. The place is lit up with sort of the strobes of passing cars. It's not a busy street, that little kind of pathway along the side of the bridge. We shouldn't be surprised that there's not necessarily a lot of evidence at the moment to be going along with. We really have to wait and see. I mean, I think this is the thing. Everyone wants, and myself included, everyone wants the quick snap judgment, and we all rush to that because, you know, that's what people are asking us to give. And as a result, in the lack of evidence, we tend to fall back on what we think we know about Russia.
Let me flip it around the other way, Mark. Does this look like the work of amateurs to you?
Again, I'm sorry to give you such a sort of a floppy answer. It could be. I mean, again, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, let's say a bunch of sort of crackpot nationalists with no particular state connection decided that Nemtsov just, you know, has to go because of whatever reason they decide.
Which is the only plausible thing I can think of other than state involvement.
Well, there is the midpoint, which we can come to in a minute. But they, you know, if they decide that, well, Nemtsov is a public figure. He's not, and he's a very distinctive public figure. They could have just simply sort of, you know, identified him and tracked him. They could have precisely paid someone to basically sort of access the location data on his phone. And then the rest is actually relatively straightforward. It doesn't require large numbers. It doesn't require great professionalism. So it is possible, but of course that's not the same as saying it has to be.
Is it
the
likely?
Midpoint? Well, let me put it this way. Occam's razor says that, you know, you try and go for the simplest answer.
Well, that's the Putin did at one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's simple, but then again, I mean, if Putin did it, it raises the question of why. I mean, why do you murder Nemtsov, but periodically stick Navalny in house arrest? I still can't see why it was so important, and that's the fundamental thing. We can't just simply say, well, because he's mad. The notion that either ultranationalists, who, you know, we know there's a lot of exceedingly nasty people who feel empowered by this whole toxic propaganda campaign that the Kremlin has indeed orchestrated, or the other possibility being one that you've raised in your writings, is that it could be some sort of elements within the security apparatus who either chose to take matters in their own hands because they wanted to, or who felt they had been given some kind of nod and a wink. Mm-hmm. That's also entirely possible, because it does speak to, and you mentioned it in today's Daily Vertical, this sort of notion of, do we see Russia as this extraordinarily controlled monolith, or do we actually see it as this sort of cauldron of bubbling factional and political and individual rivalries, people hoping to advance their career by taking initiative and so forth. And I tend to be more of the bubbling cauldron variety. So it could well be people thought, oh, this is really what's intended when we see Kiselyov on TV or whatever. Mm. You know, we think that this is a message, and therefore that's what we're going to do.
So credit where credit is due. On this morning's Daily Vertical, I was channeling you, Mark, and you were speaking on Sean's podcast yesterday. So I want to throw credit where credit is due there. Sean, what is your take on this? You read Mark's. You've been reading what everybody's been writing. You've read Mark's piece. You had Mark on your podcast yesterday. What's your take right now?
Yeah, I mean, I when I first heard that Nemtsov was murdered, it was, of course, shocking, and I was kind of in shock all day. As a result, it was a quite interesting reaction on my part, because I've never been much of a supporter of Nemtsov, but just the act itself was incredibly shocking. I tend more on Mark's side and kind of like waiting and seeing what we actually know about this and kind of questioning our assumptions, because as you've already raised and Mark just raised and he raised on my podcast and you raised in the Daily Vertical, this is really how you understand the murder really says something about how you understand Russia.
Yeah.
And I think that the way the murder itself and how it's being played out in public discourse and political discourse is incredibly important, because I think that Nemtsov's murder is being essentially Nemtsov has become a political football in many ways. He's a martyr. It's a provocation, according to the government. It's, you know, Charlie Hebdo. It's all sorts of conspiracy theories, and you're getting them, you know, also on the other side, in terms of making assumptions about the centrality of control that Putin has over the government, the tight power vertical where power flows down from the top. So I think this is really a moment where we need to kind of think about how we understand this system. And I tend more to the idea that this really pretends a breakdown and reveals a breakdown of the environment, the political environment in Russia, and really what happens when you create, when the government has created an environment in which you have, you know, fifth columnists and traitors and this kind of hateful language. And many people, of course, pointed this out. And it's just wondering what is going on, what's going to happen next. Now, I think it's interesting about one of the things I've been kind of monitoring is the leaks that are coming out of the investigative committee to the press.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite interesting what has happened over the last couple of days. Right when the murder happened, we were getting all sorts of leaks, like Kommersant was reporting things about cameras, reporting things about how the police don't think it's professional. And then it's interesting that Markin comes out and makes statements, the spokesman for the investigative committee, makes statements about basically people shouldn't listen to leaks. You should only listen to official statements from the investigative committee. And it's interesting, all the leaks pretty much stopped.
Mm, that was a warning then.
Yeah. It seemed to be a warning to get people to shut up. And, you know, as we all know, the Russian press, certain publications have very good sources within the police. And it's interesting to think about how, you know, what the police know that we don't know. Now, mm-hmm. I read on Medusa yesterday that they have over 100 people working this case,
right,
from all aspects of the security apparatus.
Now, that's not unusual, and even in these cases that they never solved and never intended to solve. They had over 100 people, if my memory serves me correctly, working on the Galina Starovoytova assassination back,
sure,
in 1998. So I'm not sure that speaks to it. And this is one of the things, but you do point out to go to something like that's very important here, Sean, is how serious are they trying to figure out?
Yes.
Because if they already know, then it's just a whitewash, right?
And look who they put in charge of the investigation. This Igor Krasnov, he headed the investigation of the Markelov murder.
Yeah.
And he actually solved this one.
Right, right.
We're all trying to read the signals of what's going to happen and what is happening. And I just put this stuff out there for people to possibly consider that they might be taking this murder quite seriously. And then, of course, we have Putin's statements, you know, depending on how you want to take those, but him calling it a political murder and rapping the police for this, you know, you could read that however you want. But I think we should consider all of this information as we, you know, and how we evaluate the murder.
With Putin,
and how it plays out.
As far as Putin's statements go, I've learned through painful experience to just not pay attention to what he says and watch what he does.
But other people do.
Yeah, 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 that's true. And what kind of message might he be trying to send? Along these lines, I mean, the journalist Konstantin Gaza had an interesting piece in Forbes on this, where he said this was basically a black swan. Those who are familiar with the black swan theory, basically in a shocking event that has a huge repercussions that was completely unforeseen, but that in retrospect, it looks completely obvious that it was inevitable. Right. But Gaza argues that basically this points to a breakdown in the Russian state, which is along the lines of what Sean was saying. I mean, what do I think of this right now? I mean, my thinking's evolved. I mean, the day after the assassination, after a late night Facebook chat with Sean, it was late night for me. It was midday for you. I was sitting in my local pub trying to figure out what the hell I was going to write the next day. My initial take was, oh my God, this is the start of a great terror, because I assumed A, this is a professional hit. B, on somebody who is, you know, under constant surveillance. They got away clean. And the only motive I can come up with is terror. That's the only motive. It's random. It's like I think I wrote to you, is Putin actually going all Stalin on us? I think I actually, those are my exact words in a message to you during that conversation. But my take has evolved on it. I mean, as I said in the Daily Vertical this week, I see two broad possibilities. And both of these broad possibilities are scary, to say the least. They're terrifying, and they are terror or chaos. Because if the Kremlin was involved, and we've not ruled that out by any stretch of the imagination, I mean, I think Mark is, you're right to point out that you were not saying we should rule this out. You're saying we just shouldn't jump to this conclusion. But this just shows you how polarized the world of Kremlinology has become. If the Kremlin was involved, then the only conceivable motive that I can come up with is terror. I mean, there's no reason to hit Nemtsov per se. And I don't see anything about Nemtsov that was threatening them. I don't buy this stuff about this report he was coming out about Ukraine, that is something. That report's going to come out, and there's going to be a lot more attention on it now than there ever would have been before, right? That report's coming out in a couple of weeks. So I don't buy that it was anything to do with Nemtsov. The only conceivable motive I could see is to instill fear in the Kremlin's critics by showing them that now they are not just subject to arrest and harassment, but to assassination. And it can happen at any time. It's random. Call it hybrid terror. I did call it hybrid terror on my blog. The other possibility I see is that the Kremlin didn't give the order. The semi-professionalism of this hit, I guess, Mark, is what I would call it, because it these guys were not the Keystone Cops. They clearly, it took a degree of coordination and, if not professionalism, at least competence to pull this thing off. And the fact that, no, maybe Nemtsov wasn't surveilled 24/7, but he was surveilled a lot. He was surveilled a lot. We have to, I think we all have to agree on that. The man was watched. His phone was monitored. Suggests that perhaps the Kremlin's lost control of the organized use of violence in this at this level, and even in the shadow of the Kremlin itself, which implies chaos. If that's the case, we're back to the 90s, but we're back to the 90s in a very poisoned political environment, even more poisoned than we had in the 90s. So either of those things, and those are two broad virsi that I have there, I'm not willing to go any farther than those two. But what do you guys see as the virsi out there? I mean, not what's out there. What do you think when you're looking at this? What this likely was, Mark?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting when you said sort of going all Stalin, because again, obviously there's that fact that there's also a massive debate as to quite what Stalinism was about, how far it was carefully choreographed from the top and how far it actually often span out of control as local agents use the opportunities of terror for their own personal advantages or because they thought that's what was needed. And then you have the sort of the dizzy with success moment when actually, even Stalin's thinking, actually, hold on a minute, this could become counterproductive. And so in that respect, I mean, just make a couple of points before, as a way of kind of answering that question rather than just simply saying, oh, I don't know. I think it is clear that the Kremlin itself is either doing an unusually good job of appearing to be concerned about this. And I do think it's interesting that General Krasnov was appointed, because he's someone who's come up on my radar in different ways beforehand, not just because of the high-profile cases in which he's been involved, but actually talking to people within the police and security apparatus. You know, often when I'm one of the things I'm interested in is, well, you know, who do you rate? Who are the people who actually... And his name cropped up as a genuine... Seriozny Chilovyek. A lot of people sort of use that expression for, this is a serious guy. I mean, he's terribly meticulous. He's a bit of a bulldog, and so, gets his teeth into it and won't let go. doesn't sound like to me the sort of person you put in charge of a make-work investigation.
And he's a true copper. He's not a political.
He's not one of these people who've just flown across from the FSB or whatever. So that's interesting. And also just one other little sort of point. Life News, which is, of all the various agencies, the one that's closest to the FSB, hasn't actually been particularly forthcoming on this particular case. It's a negative data point, but it's an interesting one. But anyway, so to go back to what I think is going on, well, let me draw a parallel with what's been happening in Ukraine. Because in a way, we've had two very different models. Crimea. Very quick, very neat, very, very clearly and carefully choreographed. And then you have what's going
exactly
on in the Donbass.
Exactly 1 year before this assassination, too. Exactly 1 year
exactly,
before this assassination.
Exactly, indeed. But if you look at what's going on in the Donbass, much, much more messy. Yes, of course, there are Russian soldiers and Spetsnaz there who are clearly being ordered by the central command. And then there's a whole variety of other agents that are kind of controlled by Russia, but actually also have their own agendas and often will just sort of spin out of control.
And
every now and then,
a civilian airliner.
Yeah, exactly. They're either unprofessional and stupid or murderous, thuggish. They sometimes are acting on what they think are orders and then need to be reined in, or sometimes they just don't care about the orders and it's more or less, well, what are you going to do about it? Relying on the fact that it's easier to beg forgiveness afterwards and all these kinds of things. You know, you have an absolute mess there. One in which actually it would be very difficult for Russia to either extricate itself or bring about a peace if any deal was made. And in some ways, I think these are the two metaphors that we're dealing with. Crimea was neat because it was A, quick. That's very important. Mm-hmm. B, there was a sort of a straightforward structure, the sort of the local political elite that could just be sort of shunted into place. And C, it was a kind of controlled environment. As soon as you get to the, as it were, the bigger world, as soon as it takes longer and so forth, actually Russia's limits, or rather the Kremlin's limits, become quite apparent. So this is, I do think, what is going on in Russia as a whole, that you have a state that clearly has a lot of power and resources still, but not the kind of power and resources that it can control everything all the time. It's created this environment in which it almost seems to be trying to sort of manufacture a culture of predicting the will of the Kremlin and presenting the Kremlin with the goodies, like a cat that comes and deposits a dead sparrow in your lap. And at the same time, it's encouraged feuding between multiple, often competitive and overlapping agencies and institutions. So it's almost created this kind of model, which basically says, you want to show your loyalty? You want to show how serious you are? Well, you know, basically just go out there and find some way of proving it. And we may retrospectively bless or damn what you do. Mm-hmm. Now, that's at a kind of institutional level. But if that's happening at the top of the system, well, I'm sure it's going to happen further down the system as well. And therefore, I mean, I think it does create this actually beneath the disciplined appearance, a really quite undisciplined and chaotic environment, which, let's face it, is not exactly a novelty for Russia.
So if pushed to the wall, what does your gut tell you this is? Kremlin order, B, rogue security officers, C, nationalists, amateurs. I mean, you know, because when I say rogue security, I include in that they may be operating with some of the Novorossiya or elements and so on and so forth. But I see these three things: Kremlin order. Will someone please rid me of this troublesome priest? You know, this rogue elements. Maybe there's a fourth version. The fourth version would be what you're just describing. There, people think that they're acting to please the Kremlin, when they wanted nothing of the sort, and then just something just random.
Well, if you do push me to the wall, which is an incidentally unfortunate metaphor when we're talking about Stalinism, I mean, I would say that the person who pulled the trigger was probably a nationalist rather than a trained professional. But somewhere down the line, there has to be some link with the security apparatus or with people within the security apparatus, not least exactly for the tracking and the fingering of where he is. Now, as I said, that could just simply be a sympathizer within the security apparatus, or it could be someone who was kind of running it. But again, I don't think it was operating because the director of the FSB or the president or whatever said, go and rub out that Nemtsov.
Well, it would never happen that way. It'd be a black op, and it would be a, will someone please rid me of this troublesome police, and the thing would be off the books, basically.
Well, it would be off the book. I mean, obviously, things are always off the books, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're not ordered. I mean, it's a little bit like, again, going way, way back. When I was doing my doctorate on the invasion of Afghanistan, one of the things I was trying desperately to find was the document that says, okay, we're going in. And I spent ages not being able to find it. And then I realized, because there wasn't one. Because it was a verbal order that was conveyed to the Minister of Defense, who made a verbal order to the Chief of the General Staff, who gave a verbal... Yeah, and so forth down the line. The first place there was paper was actually at the level of the Turkestan military district.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is still the culture that prevails today. You know, yes, these things are never recorded, but that doesn't mean to say that it's not actually explicit.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Yeah, I think this, and this is one of the, in my initial reaction, is the fear that this is the Donbass come home.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you have a lot of, I mean, if you want to put it into also a larger context in terms of the war in eastern Ukraine, you have first the victory, you have the Minsk agreement. Then you have the victory in Debaltseve on the part of the separatists. And then you have a stop. And you also have to wonder, you know, how these kind of hardcore Nova Russia people are viewing, you know, the Kremlin in terms of them not going full throttle on this and not pushing further into eastern Ukraine. Now, there could be all sorts of, you know, reasons for this, but, you know, these kind of rogue elements operating and crossing the border between Russia and Ukraine and going and fighting and coming back, you know, these are quite, you know, autonomous forces in many ways. And one could imagine, and this is just a suggestion, I don't really know for sure, but one could imagine, you know, this kind of effect coming back and striking into the heart of the Russian domestic politics.
What would the motive be in that case?
I mean, I think this is one of the hardest questions to answer.
It is.
You know.
But you're a smart guy, and that's why I asked.
We saw this during these kind of anti-Maidan protests, these kind of slogans of calling for Putin to kind of cleanse the country of traitors and all of this. I mean, the motive could just be as simple as cleansing the country of a traitor, you know, in a high profile one. That could certainly be a motive. It could be in terms of a provocation, in terms of kind of, you know, ratcheting up the domestic political atmosphere. Of course, this is what the Kremlin is putting out there. But it's not inconceivable in this sense. It doesn't have to be a direct hit against the Kremlin, but it certainly has sharpened the rhetoric in the country. To potentially, I mean, one of my fears is when the Volkov announced, the organizer for the protest, immediately announced that we're not going to march in the outskirts of Moscow. We're going to march downtown. And then they appealed for the funeral march, essentially, in the center of town. And the government wisely agreed to this, because I feared that this could definitely be a confrontation brewing.
Yeah, no, if they did not give permission for that march, that could have got ugly.
So that situation was diffused. And I think, you know, how things will play out is a big question, and how, in terms of how we understand what the motive is. I personally can't put my finger on the motive outside of just eliminating a high profile oppositionist who's been branded as a traitor.
Mark, would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think it is interesting that, I mean, Nemtsov has been particularly heavily associated with the opposition to the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, obviously Navalny, not only
he's been opposed,
house arrest. He's been opposed, but I mean, still, you know, corruption is much more his thing.
Yeah.
He actually, I mean, you know, obviously sort of Crimea is another matter, but, you know, he's been opposed to the war, but very much Nemtsov has been taking point on this. And then when you add in, you know, little things, the optics, Ukrainian girlfriend, half Jewish, which again, you know, from the point of view of making yourself on the hate list for the Russian ultranationalists, that doesn't hurt. You know, I think sort of this, for a variety of reasons, I do think that this looks, in terms of his, you know, being identified as a traitor, definitely I think, you know, it must be associated with the current sort of imperial project in Ukraine.
All right, another, before we move on to the second half, and I want to take a closer look at how the Kremlin's spinning this, the one thing I wanted to look at is Is this a true watershed? Because we're all, everybody's kind of looking at this as a one of these watersheds that changes the country. But again, I've seen this movie before, as I said in the Daily Vertical today. I mean, the assassination of Vlad Listiev back in 1995 was supposed to be a watershed. It wasn't. The assassination of Galina Starovoitova, which I was rather close to. I was in Petersburg at the time. I knew her and I covered that thing closely. Was supposed to be a watershed. It wasn't. The Politkovskaya assassination was supposed to be a watershed. It wasn't. Are we getting caught up in the moment again? Or is there something different here, that this is a true watershed? What do you guys think there?
I don't think it's going to – is a watershed in that terms. I think it's a watershed for the opposition.
Mm.
And in terms of like how – and you kind of posed this question yesterday on the Daily Vertical in terms of, you know, where is Navalny going to go after this? You know, because essentially he's just been promoted.
Right.
You know, he was already promoted, but now
his
position – right. But now his position is pretty much undisputed. There's no other kind of figure that one can point to in terms of a high-profile Russian oppositionist at the moment.
But he's also got a big target on his head as well. This is
He certainly does. I think this is going to – this in terms of opposition politics in Russia, there's going to have to be a major rethink, because if this is a new political situation, you have to ask, well, how do we engage in opposition politics in a new political situation? You know, do we need to change our tactics? Do we need to consider the fact that violence is now a mainstay of politics? So I think in that terms, but in terms of the kind of larger domestic politics of the country, I don't see it really being a watershed at all.
Mark?
Yeah, most watersheds actually have become apparent in hindsight. I think it's I would put it in a slightly different terms, as it were, an opportunity for change. Because the interesting thing is, if you look at the sort of the previous sort of cases that you mentioned, the most recent Politkovskaya, shocking, yes, but there wasn't any kind of an opposition movement really present at the time. I think this is a case where we actually have three different sort of situations coming together. One is the presence of, however at the moment enervated it may be, but a certain form of a core of an opposition movement, and not just Navalny, but obviously above all him, a leadership. Secondly, we have growing economic crisis, which again gives a very, very different overall context in terms of what it means for the country and what it means for the elite and internal tensions and pressures. And then thirdly, the fact of the Nemtsov assassination, high profile, shocking, and so forth. Now, put all those together, and one may well find in hindsight that we'll be saying, well, this is when actually the opposition finally did get serious, realized the need to institutionalize itself, reach out beyond its metropolitan bubble, that kind of thing. Or it might be the point where, after a certain sort of amount of breast beating and so forth, that basically people decided, look, it is clear that there's just no point in taking on the Kremlin. All that gets you is a puddle of blood on the side of a bridge. And therefore, let's just not even try. Anger or despair are equally possible. But as I said, I think this is a much more volatile environment than we've seen in the past. And it happens at a time when actually the state is getting weaker, not stronger. Mm. So whether it's a watershed remains to be seen, but it's certainly not something that isn't necessarily going to be a watershed.
It's interesting. You both looked at this from the perspective of the opposition. I was kind of thinking of it from the perspective of the regime as well. And I think I agree with Mark. It could be a watershed in the ways that it just kind of came to me during our discussion here. But if you think about this, if and it all goes back to the whodunit question too, because if it was the Kremlin, and then and the only motive I just can't see another motive other than to instill terror in the opposition, and that means we're going to see more of these, right? If that is the case, that's certainly a watershed. This is the Kirov murder then. This is the Kirov assassination. And God, who's going to be Buharin? You know, somebody on Facebook took Peskov's comment about how this couldn't have been Putin and substituted Stalin for Putin and Trotsky for Nemtsov. And I read this and it was absolutely chilling. But anyway, that's one way it could be a watershed. Another way is if, as I suggested, Putin's lost control of the monopolized use of violence at this level, it's a harbinger of chaos, which would be a watershed right now. If we began to see, if we had 90s style routine assassinations in today's poisoned political environment with an emboldened security service and so on. But the third option is something, Mark, you noted earlier, and Sean as well, that if this is an indication that this is spun out of control, and, you know, is Putin going to have his dizzy with success story and rein it in at some point? And
see, maybe I'm not dial sure down. He can.
But that's, well, this is the question. But yeah. Either these are the three, again, I'm trying to think of the spectrum of possibilities here. And these are the three I see, and these are the three ways that this could conceivably be a watershed. Anybody else have anything to say on this before we move on to the next part? Yeah, go ahead.
If I can just kind of respond to those three. I mean, the Kirov murder, I don't like the Kirov murder
but,
parallel. And I really think it's dangerous to think, you know, Putin is not Stalin. This is not a Stalinist regime. We really must be aware of that. But, I mean, I think the point is that if it's about terror, then actually in some ways Nemtsov is a bad choice because Nemtsov is just too high profile. A middle-ranking potential opposition supporter isn't going to bracket – yeah, but it's not going to bracket themselves. They're not going to think, well, if Nemtsov can get killed, so could I. I think in some ways the power of terror was not in something like the Kirov murder. The Kirov murder was just because Kirov had to be killed, and then it provided a suitable excuse. The power of terror is when it's your next door neighbor who gets dragged off. So in some respects, I mean, I think in this respect, it's if Stalinism is the aim, then this was a bad target. But to move to the other end, I mean, the interesting thing is that it's so much easier to create chaos than it is to rein it back. I don't think this is a sort of that suddenly it's going to sort of open up floodgates. If nothing else, I mean, you have to realize that very, very few assassinations or murders, shall we say, in Russia actually are political on a national level. The overwhelming majority are contract killings, which are settling of scores between gangsters and against business people who are in bed with gangsters, which is why, although the level of contract killing is still exceedingly high, it gets such little mention. Because actually most people, they don't think it's going to affect them. And they frankly tend, I mean, again, sort of in my own conversation, people tend to say, well, you know, if they killed you, it's basically because you were in bed with them. So no loss, really.
Right.
I mean, so there is that world. Or else there's the local politics, which is much, much more bloody than national politics. It's actually rare for us to really be able to point to a sort of a recent killing. That actually one could definitely say that had the Kremlin's fingerprints on, in a way that, for example, you know, I'm convinced that the Litvinenko murder was quite that. But let's say, yeah, that actually what this represents is an increasing lack of control within the state, which I think is true, and that we can see this continue, especially as intra-state rivalries over resources and power and access to the president sharpen, which I think we're seeing happen. I'm not entirely sure what the hell Putin can do about it. I think we probably will see a bunch of ultranationalists in due course arrested and sort of show-trialed, in effect, because firstly, Putin has to show to the outside world that he's serious about this investigation. Secondly, as a warning to what happens if you overstep the bounds and, in effect, embarrass the Kremlin, which is one of the biggest crimes in the unwritten codex of this current regime. And that might have a certain salutary impact. But I really am unconvinced that he has, as it were, the control to, if we're going to go back to this dangerous parallel, have a dizzy with success moment, which really did see the tap very definitely sort of turned off for a while before it was turned on again.
Yeah. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the ways the Kremlin is spinning the Nemtsov assassination and what this spin tells us about what may be in store. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the newly launched SRB podcast. Ben Judah, wish you could have been with us. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
И проверяется уже версия, связанная с внутри украинскими событиями. Не секрет, что среди...
методы Майдана. Лейтмотивом стало убийство Бориса Немцова.
Убийство Бориса Немцова – это первый шаг в этом направлении.
Эксперты уверены, что речь идет о тщательно подготовленном преступлении.
Националистов к убийству оппозиционного политика Бориса Немцова.
You can learn a lot from the way the Kremlin spins an event like this. An article in the Kremlin mouthpiece Известия this week cited officials from the investigative committee as saying the main versia they are following in the Nemtsov killing is, get this, it was carried out on the orders of the Ukrainian Security Service, and the assassination was carried out by Chechen militants, the so-called Dudayev Battalion, who are fighting against pro-Moscow separatists in Ukraine. Russian state television has also suggested predictably that the CIA was involved because Washington has determined that Nemtsov is more useful as a martyr than he is alive. So we have Ukrainians, Chechens, Americans. All we need are some gay banderovtsy who happen to have Georgian relatives, and we'll have the full house of the Kremlin's enemies list here. Now, the first thing that jumped out at me when I read that Izvestia piece, and it doesn't take much in Izvestia to blow my mind, given the things they've published over the recent years. The first thing that jumped out at me is that they're basically saying implicitly that the Russian security services are so incompetent that the Ukrainian SBU could pull something off like this right under their noses. I mean, really, think about it. I mean, it's nuts. Mark, what do you make of this? Now, this piece does not necessarily reflect policy, but it's Izvestia at the end of the day. It's the pro-Kremlin daily. Sean, you talked about leaks in the first. There's leaks and there's leaks. When a leak appears in Izvestia, it seems to me that's a signal that that's a leak that they was endorsed, encouraged, probably even spoon-fed. Mark, I'd like to hear from both of you on this. But Mark, what do you make of this kind of?
Well, first of all, I mean, clearly, I was thoroughly disappointed that the British Secret Service didn't also make it into the mix, because they're usually there. So, I mean, I'm thinking there's a snub. No, I mean, I think what this does say is, again, I think it's a fascinating case study in how this system works and the extent to which actually we shouldn't assume that everything is carefully choreographed from the top. You know, who the they are. I mean, because the first reflex is, again, clearly was, you know, just like if you've got a missile locked onto your fighter, you sort of release flares and chaff of every kind in every direction to try and distract the missile. And that's when we had everyone jumping in with their own pet lunacy, which is interesting for two things. One is that it actually suggests that, at least in the part of some people, they assume that the Kremlin might have been responsible. Because otherwise, why else do you throw up interference? Mm-hmm. But secondly, again, I think it showed that there wasn't a kind of a pre-canned line, which actually, again, if it was a Kremlin hit, you'd think they'd have worked out right from the beginning. I mean, it wouldn't have been nice if within 24 hours they'd been able to present there, and this is a suspect who was unfortunately shot while being apprehended, or something like that. But, you know, actually, they clearly didn't have some line. And so I think what you tend to get is exactly the initiative of the individuals. You know, it doesn't matter if we're talking about RT or doesn't matter if we're talking about Izvestia. I don't think that these people are all just having someone telexing them, this is your line. I think they kind of know that it's their job is to come up with all kinds of speculation. So I think that was kind of phase one, was everyone thinking, oh, righto, you know, another situation where we have to run interference for the Kremlin. Let's see what great stories we can come up with.
Well, you also had Peskov's comment, and Peskov is getting pretty close to the source itself, saying that this was a provocation to discredit Russia. He didn't get
exactly.
more detail than that, but that's the Kremlin speaking right there.
That's the Kremlin. And that's actually a relatively straightforward and not, I mean, obviously, you know, wrong, but nonetheless, I mean, that's actually quite moderate.
But do you see any indication do you have any indication they're not running with this kind of thing anymore?
Well, there is much less, because then you have this sort of I think there was a second phase where actually sort of having thrown all this stuff out, people were trying to look at what is the Kremlin line. And actually you saw a lot of the reporting move a lot less into the sort of this kind of grand meta story about, you know, it was Ukrainian-funded Chechens or whatever, and actually moving much more into the nuts and bolts of the investigation and so forth. Again, is a sort of, you see, we are taking it seriously. And then, and you raise this point, while everyone was busy trying to actually sort of cover it, and there were all kinds of leaks, and in some ways journalists were actually, starting to become journalists again for a while, and actually do investigation rather than wild and random and lunatic speculation. Then you had this whole shut the hell up sort of message going out there. Let us do our thing.
What day did that shut the hell up message come out there this week?
It was 2 days ago.
2 days ago. So it was Wednesday. The SVSD piece appeared Monday. Putin made his remarks
On
Wednesday as well, the same day as the shut the hell up message came out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sean, what do you make of this, the spin?
Yeah, I think I agree with Mark on this, in the sense you get this kind of like vomiting of various conspiracy theories at first, and then what we're seeing now is some kind of consolidation. Now you'll of course get all these all of these kinds of things thrown on various media channels, because they like their drama, and they like to whip up all sorts of conspiracies and speculation. It's kind of their bread and butter. But in terms of the kind of standard line, I think that we're going to probably see that developing in the next weeks or so, how this thing is going to actually be framed. And I think that's going to tell us a lot in terms of which direction the investigation is going, right, and how the Kremlin understands what happened,
mm-hmm,
and how they're going to use this and exploit this, if that's the case, for whatever purposes that they intend. So I think Mark is right in a sense. It does say a lot in terms of how this kind of system works, where everybody is kind of throwing out, this kind of initial reaction from xenophobia to Charlie Hebdo and all of this stuff. And then we have this consolidation of opinion.
Right. No, Ben's not here, so I'll channel him a little bit. Ben had a tweet that caught my eye early in the week when he said that I was going to ask him this question directly. Whom the Kremlin blames for the Nemtsov killing is a signal of where the politics is going. At a time, he said, it's a bad sign that the Ukrainians keep coming up. Why don't we take this a little bit further? Where do you see the different ways, the different possibilities of who the Kremlin blames for this? And what does that portend? If the nutty conspiracy theories about the Ukrainian SBU and the Dudayev battalion and the CIA, and Mark, don't worry, I'm sure MI5 will get in there at some point. If that continues, what does that show? If nationalists are rounded up, what does that show? What do you think the spectrum of possibilities shows us?
I think if they continue with the kind of Ukrainian conspiracy theory stuff, CIA, FM, it's basically business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has been their kind of line for a while now in terms of how they understand their relationship to the outside world, how they understand that they think there's a target on their back, or at least Putin thinks there's a target on his back personally, that this is really in a kind of narcissism all about them. So I think if that's going to be the main line, then we pretty much do have business as usual here.
But what does that mean? What does that mean about how they understood this assassination? Does it suggest more culpability, Kremlin culpability, or indirectly? Or is it just, this is how we're going to cover this thing up, and we don't know how the hell this happened?
I think it's hard to say, because, it could be both. It could be that, we did it, so we're going to shroud it in all of this usual stuff. Or it could be there is a major security – I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
If the Kremlin didn't do this, this is a major security breach right outside of Red Square, right outside the Kremlin. And we don't know if the cameras work. We don't know what they recorded. We don't know. Everybody's denying taking responsibility,
right,
it seems, for what happened. And that could be one reason why they'll continue with this kind of conspiracy stuff, is to basically say, look, it wasn't our fault. But as you pointed out, by saying that it's, Dudayev or the SBU, they're kind of implicitly admitting that there is an F up somewhere in security.
Right.
Right. Mark, like, we got the better of us.
Mark?
Yeah, I very much agree with what Sean has been saying. I think the issue is not that we can actually learn whether they were behind it from their propaganda or whatever, because it could just as easily be that it's just how that they respond to a situation they don't know. And I'll be honest, I mean, there's also, I think, an element, obviously, there's a waiting to see if the investigation quickly throws up results, and that will also change things. But I think there's probably an element in which they're waiting to see. This is not a single strategy. This is in part a sort of a piece of improvisation. They throw out ideas, they see what happens, they see what people respond to, and in part they will let that, I think, guide them. Yes, of course, if they keep pushing the sort of the Ukrainian line, which, you know, I think is one of the least credible of all the possible sort of ones. I mean, short of, I don't know, someone yet come up with aliens or similar. But then it says several things about the fact that they don't care about the truth, mm-hmm. That they have just simply decided that they're just going to slot it into their toxic narrative and use it as that and be damned. And that doesn't necessarily guide policy, because it's not as if they're going to actually decide, well, in that case, we're going to bomb Kiev or anything like that. But it does say something about the fact that they do not intend to use this as a basis for any kind of real change. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the interesting thing is, if they do end up saying it was a bunch of sort of loony ultranationalists, the sort who, let's be honest, Putin has been palling around with for quite some time, mm-hmm. you know, with his own favorite biker gang and all that sort of thing, then they're going to have to do something about it. And they're going to have to therefore recognize that actually this alliance between the Kremlin and that kind of nationalistic, patriotic, Russian Orthodox, vigilante mix isn't always a good thing, and you know, again, it carries with it implicit sort of promises of a certain sort of policy change or whatever. You know, if we are talking watershed moments, as I said, I mean, I'm unconvinced that Putin can actually bring back sort of proper state control. What he can do are two things. One is make it clear that actually he is not willing to accept or reward that kind of initiative from the bottom. So that, you know, mm-hmm. there can be a message that this is not actually the route to fame and fortune. And secondly, he can specifically allow for some high-profile cases against some nationalists without the usual kind of apologetic tone that tends to crop up when they do end up having to prosecute nationalists. Mm-hmm. Again, as a signal that actually just because you shroud yourself in the Russian flag does not mean to say that you can actually flout the laws with impunity, which would be a positive step. Again, it wouldn't be a game changer, but nonetheless, it would be positive. So, I mean, I think it's possible that this thing can, all this stuff can be sort of can become part of a slightly more positive spin. But really, they have to actually start getting real about it. Mm. And until they do that, then frankly, this just simply becomes part of the sort of the theater of absurd Russia is beleaguered propaganda that really has contributed and created this situation.
Do you see that this can just be one of this looks big now, but it's just going to be a blip, and this things just keep carrying on as they were? I mean, when Sean, you mentioned business as usual. Do you see that possibility, or does something have to change here?
No, it's always possible. It's always possible. I mean, again, this is what I mean about sort of watersheds. We only really see them afterwards. Yeah. That if the opposition doesn't really galvanize at all, that if we don't have any further killings, that if you have a sort of a slight sort of restoration or rollback of control over sort of maverick agencies, but nothing that's really going to sort of change the balance of power. And if no other bad stuff happens, I mean, what tends to happen is that individual incidences are not important. What happens is one gets accreted to by something else. Mm-hmm. Something else happens, and therefore, you know, I mean, the same again. Let me just use for whatever reason I'm going back to my childhood, going back to when I was doing my doctorate and the Afghan War.
You did your doctorate in your childhood?
No, it just feels like it now. That basically, the Afghan War was in and of itself not that important. Obviously, it was terrible for the 15,000 who died and their families and so forth. But basically, it was an entirely supportable burden for the Soviet system. What mattered was actually that the Afghan War became a symbol for so much else that was wrong with the system. when all kinds of other things came along, an Afghan war plus Chernobyl, plus there is no food in the shops, plus various other things. And then these things accrete to form something bigger. Well, so too, I mean, the Nemtsov death could end up just being a terrible blip. Or it could end up being part of, you know, put together with other things, part of a narrative. Well, this is why 2015 was the year the Putin regime really started to crumble. Or this is why 2015 was the year that we saw a shift towards much more brutal authoritarianism. Whatever. It's how things will connect that matters.
No, there's Sean. Did you have any thoughts on this? I wanted to give you a chance to jump in here.
No, I don't. Have anything to add on that. I think you know how things play out over the next months, weeks, months, and over the year will determine the importance of all of this.
I mean, the last thing I wanted to hit on before we wrap it up and I go out and get drunk on my birthday is basically. And this kind of thought came to me as we were doing the podcast today, but. Each major period of big political change in post-Soviet Russia has been accompanied by violence. If you go back to the Russia's original sin, the shelling of the parliament on October 4th, 1993, that heralded in basically the Yeltsin era, really. Because what you had between the collapse of the Soviet Union and that was kind of this interim period. The apartment bombings in the second Chechen incursion into Dagestan, the apartment bombings in the Second Chechen War heralded the rise and consolidation of the Putin regime, again, born in violence. Is 2014, 2015, does that fall into the, do you think, and I know this is all perfect in hindsight and we don't have the benefit of hindsight now, but I'm doing it anyway because it's fun. But does the Ukraine war and now the Nemtsov assassination and what it may portend, do we appear to be heading into one of those violent periods that heralds change?
I certainly think it's a possibility in the sense of, and if you broaden out the use of violence in general, including, you know, not just the Nemtsov murder, but the what's going on in eastern Ukraine, all of these people who are going across the border and fighting will come back at some point. You know, they'll come back because they come back. They'll come back because there's some sort of agreement. And the question I have is what, you know, especially if you think of other historical moments like, you know, World War One, for example, which of course is a much bigger thing, but nonetheless, you have people coming back, also after the Afghan War, you have people coming back trained in violence, their way of life is violence, and when they come back to normal society, how do they reintegrate or not and carry on if they're kind of revved up in this nationalist, ideologies, how they prosecute politics in back in Russia. Mm-hmm. I think this is a big question, and the ramifications of this will be spread over, I think, several years. And in terms of Putin's ability to contain this, I think there's very few levers to do this. Mm-hmm. Because after all, you know, it comes back to how we understand this system. There isn't much institutionalization in terms of like structures, but this is a kind of personalized network politics where a bunch of autonomous actors do certain things to either please the Kremlin or carry out their own agendas. And how these people coming back from the Donbass will figure in that, I think, is a big question.
Mark, last word to you before we wrap it up.
Yeah, when you talk about heading into a period of violence, I think we're definitely in a period of violence. Just ask the, 6,000 plus Ukrainians who've already died and so forth. And in that respect, I mean, are we in a period of change? Absolutely. I mean, I felt this, frankly, when they annexed Crimea, and it's only sort of been all the more important ever since they moved into this mess in the Donbass. And it's not so much, and I think here I disagree with Sean in yours. I mean, it's not so much because of the people coming back. I don't think we're going to see sort of Russian Fry Corps or whatever, any more than the Afghans became particularly significant in and of themselves. I think it's more that actually this is a period in which we've seen major political blunders. And in many ways, I think we're seeing the sort of the fossilization, the senescence of the Putin regime increasingly. And this is what happens with almost all, especially authoritarian regimes, but frankly, all regimes that last too long, they begin to become caricatures of themselves. And I think, therefore, you know, we have a sort of a political blunder which is going to leading to a dramatic worsening of the economic crisis that anyway was going to bite, again, because of political decisions that had already been made in the past. And then you put that together with, yes, the impact of Ukraine and, you know, not just the people who will come back, but things like, you know, the families of the boys who are not going to be coming back and such like. I mean, I think there is grounds for that. But much, much more important, I think, are going to be political disquiets amongst the masses, which might manifest itself in things like labor unrest rather than necessarily directly sort of political actions. But, you know, as we see the gap between wage rises and price rises opening more and more dramatically, that is going to have an impact. There's no way around it. We have, in part connected with that, disquiet within the elite. And I think increasingly a sense that actually the Kremlin is not doing its job, which is managing the country effectively in the interests of the elite. So, I mean, I do think that we are heading to a period of a really quite sustained and serious challenge to the current regime. And again, you're absolutely right about the way that periods of violence have created each new regime. I think actually that period of violence has already started. The question is what's going to be coming from it.
Yeah. And I would add to all the things you said, the incredibly poisonous atmosphere we have right now, in which the Kremlin appears to have lost control over its monopoly on violence. All right. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and East European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the newly launched SRB podcast, which you should all listen to. Ben Judah, we wish you could have joined us. Hope to see you next time. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.